Why do some countries advance while others fall behind? Who benefits from economic growth and who doesn't? How do inequality and climate change affect people, especially the most marginalized? What role can data play in answering questions like these and informing policies that promote economic justice? Let's find out on Voices in Development. Hello and welcome to our podcast. I'm your host, Catherine Cheney. We're coming to you from the Economic Growth Center at Yale University, which is focused on economics and data-driven insights for equitable development. Today, we're going to discuss the experience of women and girls in India through a unique and important lens, India's constitution. We'll ask what India's constitution has meant for gender equality in the country at 75 years of independence. Our conversation will cover the history of the Indian constitution and its importance in society, how institutions meant to safeguard the constitution sometimes work and sometimes fail, and the relevance of the constitution in India today, even as the notion of women's rights has evolved. We're joined by Rohini Pandey, Henry J. Hines II, Professor of Economics and Director of the Economic Growth Center at Yale University, Barkha Dutt, one of India's most prominent journalists, who founded the independent digital media platform Mojo Story and recently published To Hell and Back, Humans of COVID, and Rohit Day, a legal historian with a focus on South Asia, who is also an associate professor in Yale's Department of History. We're releasing this episode on Republic Day, a public holiday in India, celebrating the date the Constitution came into effect, January 26, 1950. But no matter when you're listening, you're in for a really fascinating discussion. Now, onto the conversation. Let's begin with some historical background. Rohit, you've explored how the Indian Constitution came to permeate everyday life in India. Can you tell us a little bit more about that history?
So the Indian Constitution was a document which had a kind of imagination for radical transformation. Unlike most post-colonial states, it is a constitution that Indians wrote themselves. So most sort of former colonies had constitutions written for them by officials in London. And there were two other assemblies contemporaneous to India, Pakistan and Israel. Neither of them could achieve consensus on a constitutional document. And even though the writers of the constitution were sort of political elites in some ways, it's quite clear that even at the time of its writings, it was a site of massive discussion across different areas of society and regions of India. If I want to just sort of briefly address the question of gender, which I think we're going to come to, it's a constitution that took gender equality as a sort of given. So, and this sort of reiterated a longstanding commitment by various political parties in India that saw independence as not just mere political freedom, but also a kind of radical transformation of society and economy. So the constitution begins with promising sort of justice, and it puts economic and social justice almost ahead of political justice. So the constitution provided universal adult franchise and votes to women, in some cases almost simultaneously with places like France and, you know, well ahead of places like Switzerland or even the U.S. South. It provided for not just sort of formal equality, but also recognized that to have real equality between men and women or across sort of social communities, you have to allow for programs that specifically target embedded inequality. So it's legal to have sort of preferential discrimination for women and children in India. They also had a lot of promissory clauses for the future. So they saw things like equal pay for equal work, fair family laws, maternity benefits, free education. But they recognized the limitations of the state and sort of put this as a promissory note for the future. And in some ways, the challenge after independence was that while these goals were laid out, the state chose not to implement them or in some cases could not implement them. And really from the 1970s onwards, we see a very concerted movement, both by sort of women's organizations, but also other civil society groups that take these promises seriously and try to sort of either work through courts or through political parties and civil societies to sort of implement them. It also sees the rise of an anti-women's rights constituency, and we can perhaps talk about that later as well. But what is interesting to me is that there is a document in English written almost 70 plus years ago by a group of political elites, which still shapes and frames a lot of conversations across India.
Thank you, Rohit. And Rohini and Barkha, I'd love to bring you into this. Any reactions to that, having heard a bit about the history and the role of the Constitution over the decades in India, how do you see that playing out today? And then we'll figure out, you know, there are so many themes we can draw on, but what are some initial reactions?
I mean, I just think listening to Rohit, I was struck by the fact that for most people, you know, even in a highly polarized environment, when you agree on very little else, if you say, is this constitutional, that still frames the boundaries of conversations in India. And even when you can't actually execute what the Constitution looked ahead to, the Constitution is always a kind of, I would say it's a document of hope. It's a document for what India could be. And I think there's a recognition that many things in the Constitution haven't been achieved yet, or many things are interpretative, and therefore there's a constantly shifting sense of, you know, what is in Article 14, which is right to equality for all? How do you interpret or reimagine that right to equality? We've seen laws read down by the courts most recently, for example, decriminalization of homosexuality, or after that, reading down triple talaq, which is an archaic custom by which men could just say talaq, talaq, talaq and divorce their wives among Muslim communities. So I think that the Constitution, more than perhaps any other reference point in India, defines both the limits and the potential, almost simultaneously, for how Indians imagine sort of the trajectory of the nation.
Thank you, Barkha. Can just to clarify something you said, when you say for most people, if you say, is this constitutional, that still frames the boundaries of the conversation in India. And you mean that from the general public to lawmakers and policymakers, or how does that really play out?
Yeah, I think there's a heightened awareness even among people who are not politicians of what the Samvidhan says. Is this, you know, hamar ko ye haq hai, in Hindi they would say this is our right. It's a right given to us from the Constitution. Where there is an awareness and where there is a lesser awareness even about the sort of finer points of law, there is that notion that your freedoms are derived from some place that protects them, and that is the Constitution. And Prime Minister Modi in his first term said he had only one holy book, the Constitution. And therefore, even when you hold governments to account, you remind them that you promise to abide by this book. And then you say, are you abiding by it? This is what the Constitution says. And whether it's politics, whether it's journalism, whether it's the courts, whether it's judges and whether it's citizens, I think the Constitution is a very powerful, it may almost be sometimes notional. You know, we can talk about whether how much of this is actual, but in the abstract, that idea of India is very much derived from how the Constitution frames that idea.
Rohini, I know that gender equality and women's empowerment has been a big focus of your career and is a big focus of the EGC. How do constitutional rights and how does the law play into that work?
So one thing I'm thinking about as Rohit spoke is he highlighted that India gave universal suffrage at the time of the Constitution, roughly the same time as France, and, you know, well ahead of a country like Switzerland. I think one thing that's interesting is to think about not just obviously the benefits, which we can all rattle off, but perhaps the costs when you get universal suffrage not on the back of a social movement that is fighting more broadly for women's rights. So if you think of the suffrage movement in, say, Britain or in the US, you know, the suffragists in the UK were often violent, they were broad-based, and they created, I think, a stronger movement which linked political empowerment to economic empowerment, to your rights in the workplace, to your ability to do challenge, for instance, property laws. The fact that and I think this is not just true of India, I think it's true of a number of ex-colonial countries where at the time of independence there was the sense of the human rights meant women will get suffrage. It was a bit more divorced from a discussion around a lot of economic rights that in a lot of contexts, you know, preceded actually getting political rights. And I think what we've seen as a result in India is the kind of catching up of a lot of these economic rights, bodily rights, rights determined by marriage coming after the Constitution. And a flip side, of course, of that is that, and this I think is common to other countries as well, that women entering as voters doesn't necessarily mean that women enter as leaders. And this is, I think, not just unique to India. This is also true in the U.S., where we saw, you know, 1930s, the first political parties started wooing women systematically, but it took till the 60s for us to see a lot of acts. And so I think in that context, and, I'd love to hear from Rohit on this as well, I think the fact that we actually had an amendment of the Constitution on local governments that actually put in place gender quotas for women is interesting, because that was a constitutional amendment that went one step further. Constitution always recognized the value of affirmative action, but I think it put in place political affirmative action for women.
So actually, Rohini's point brings out some of the contradictions at the time of independence. So the Indian women's movement had been fairly radical in its demands for even economic rights. So there is a National Planning Committee report from 1938 written with a large cross-section of women leaders who make demands that even today would seem radical. So they wanted wages for housework. They wanted extensive social security benefits. And Nirmala Banerjee, the economist, has a piece saying that somehow after independence, the Indian women's movement kind of put its trust in the government, thinking these things will happen. And over a point of time, when the government had to make decisions on what to prioritize, many of this sort of fell on the wayside. So it's only in the 1970s again that there is a kind of active movement that starts taking these demands seriously and sort of making claims on them. I also think the question about women as voters and women as leaders is striking. In some ways, again, before independence, there were perhaps more women present on the political sort of stage of most political parties than in the 20, 30 years immediately after. And it's worth thinking why that is. And a lot of this was because this people believe that now that we have become independent, what women should do as political, as sort of public figures is to do social work, which was seen as distinct from sort of politics. So a lot of women who were radical figures in the national movement, Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay, for example, the work they do after independence is important, but it's sort of like collating handicrafts and supporting rural craftsmen and sort of moving away from sort of parliament and these spaces. And this is a group of women who also rejected sort of special reserved seats in legislatures in the 1940s and 50s. One, they were scared that if they allotted a small set of seats, women could not contest beyond that. And we've seen this happen in places like Pakistan and Bangladesh, which have quotas in parliament, but you rarely go beyond that quota. And they also trusted that political parties would give women space, but that did not, it clearly did not happen, I mean, even up till now.
And actually, it's pretty ironic to hear, Rohit, because I was thinking that ever since I've been a journalist for more than two decades now, I have seen a kind of debate around affirmative action for women, the political representation in parliament. And actually, along the way observing it, I've actually changed my mind about whether it's a good idea. The resistance to it makes me support it. But if that resistance didn't exist, I would step back and say maybe, you know, you need that quota at the level of ticket distribution more than in the gendering of constituencies. But I do remember one point when the women's reservation legislation looked like it was going to go through. And you had other sort of intersectional pushbacks in terms of caste groups saying this is only going to benefit elite women. There was a OBC politician, Sharad Yadav, who famously said, and he said it about women like me, he said, this is something that is, this quota is only for parkati mahila. Parkati mahila, women with short hair, which was his metaphor for the sort of city slicker, urban woman. It was, of course, a very misogynistic statement, but it made us confront how complex the gender conversation is in India, because sooner or later, you'll collide with caste identity, religious identity, class identity, and so on. And I think when we look at women and the rights legally enshrined to protect them, it's a very paradoxical situation. So, you know, when you think of maternity benefits, for example, I didn't know that we were like in the United States of America, paid maternity leave is still a debate. Whereas in India, like we're pushing for why can't this be family leave? Admittedly, this is still a sort of a privileged class having this debate, but paid maternity leave is a given, and it's been a given ever since, like I was old enough to read Words, right?
But Barkha, let me jump in there. I mean, I think as an economist, I'd say there's paid. A lot of the ways in India maternity leave is paid actually by companies, not by the state. So even if it's paid by companies, you could have a view that the companies have to, or in the private sector, you have to pay into the state that then pays out.
But it's required by law, right?
But that just means you don't hire women. Women, you know, you've made women expensive directly for the company. So I think while, of course, paid maternity leave is a good idea, I think the way it's been implemented in India is it essentially tells companies you have a choice between expensive women and less expensive men. What you would want to say is that even if you want companies to pay, you want them to be paying a tax into the state, and the state pays women. So you as a company don't see this direct trade-off between hiring women. So I think, and maybe this is something that comes back often to, you know, where the Constitution stops and where policy begins, is that the Constitution can provide broad rights. But I think it's, at least as an economist, I would say it's in the formulating the policies on the basis of it that you can very often undo almost the promise of what the Constitution wanted to do.
No, I would agree with that. But I was just saying that it's such a paradoxical thing that what you think is modern, sometimes you find yourself questioning, is it really modern? And like for me, for example, just starting off in journalism, if somebody had asked me what is your caste? I would have said, I don't know. If somebody had asked me to define my feminist role models, they would have been entirely derived from the West, because that was the way I had been groomed, unfortunately, I think. And then I become a journalist and I go and report on the gang rape of a woman called Bhavri Devi in Rajasthan. She's a Dalit. It's the first time I'm actually in lived experience confronting the fact that for those of us who say we don't believe in caste, we say it because we've never experienced oppression basis caste. And anyway, long story cut short, she is deployed in a government program. She's an employee of a government program to stop child marriages. And she is raped by so-called upper caste men. Among them is the father of the one-year-old child whose marriage she was trying to shut down. And Bhavri Devi's case, and this, you know, Rohini's point, you know, of the constitution and then what happens after that, sometimes being in collision, Bhavri Devi in some ways illustrates both sides, because then her case goes to the High Court. She decides to fight for justice. And a judge of the High Court actually says that she couldn't have been raped because men of a so-called upper caste wouldn't touch a Dalit woman. She keeps fighting. Her case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. She never gets a conviction 3 decades later in her case. But through her case are birthed what are called the Vishakha guidelines, which are the sexual harassment guidelines today that are mandatory for workplaces to follow to protect women of my class against harassment. And she never got justice and it eluded her. But the judge who set the stipulated or asked for these guidelines, he declared that Bhavri Devi was a working woman who was raped at her place of work, and women at the place of work should be protected. So to me, in this story is encapsulated the fact, the clash of classes, how caste impacts this conversation, how institutions meant to safeguard the constitution sometimes work and sometimes fail. So it's that entire paradox right there.
I think that's actually a really rich example to talk through, because you have a case that was meant to remedy a wrong done to an individual who is phenomenally brave and never gets that remedy done. But instead you have coming into place a policy that puts in these guidelines that structure particularly lives of urban women. And it also goes back to Rohini's point, because what the ICC guidelines does is, again, outsources the work of dealing with sexual harassment in a kind of private forum for companies, right? And the state, again, removes itself from implementing it. The experiences of various ICC committees has been mixed. And I think there has been some debate as to whether this was the right thing to do. The reason they call these guidelines, they brought these guidelines in, is because the state did not have a law on sexual harassment. So the judge looked at the fact that India was signatory to the CEDAW, the Convention on Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and said, well, the CEDAW has these guidelines. Since we have no laws, these guidelines can step in. But it's been several years since the guidelines are put in, and there's not been a kind of comprehensive legislative project that seeks to tackle this.
I want to hear a few examples, actually. I want to narrow in on this point that Rohini and Barkha have both made about how, as Barkha put it, institutions meant to safeguard the Constitution sometimes work and sometimes fail. Or as Rohini put it, where the Constitution stops and policy begins. So we've talked about maternity leave. We've talked about sexual harassment. What are some other issues you've seen where this tension exists?
I mean, I would say most recently, we've had the release of convicted rapists who were meant to be in jail for life in a case called the Bilkis Banu case. And Bilkis Banu was a young Muslim woman who was gang raped in 2002. She finally closed her fight for justice in 2019 when she was actually awarded exemplary compensation. That's the legal phrase for it. Exemplary compensation by the Supreme Court of India. It was the highest monetary compensation to a rape survivor ever in the annals of Indian law. And just when she thought that she could sort of pick up the pieces of her life again, one of the convicts petitioned the same Supreme Court that had awarded Bilkis Banu this exemplary punishment and said, I've done 14 years. 14 years technically, and this is interpretative, is life imprisonment. And so he argued that I've done 14 years, and so now we should be released. And the Supreme Court said, well, this is now a case for the executive. This is not a case for the courts. So they sent it back to the government, in this case, the Gujarat government, to decide whether these men should be released. The Gujarat government sets up a panel, and that panel basically then recommends the release of these convicts who walk out to garlands and sweets. And we interviewed some of the members on that panel, and they basically questioned even the guilt of these convicts. They also referenced their caste and called them Brahmins and men of good values. And it was an absolute outrage. And now we're back in the Supreme Court with petitions saying, why did this happen? Send these men back to prison. And so once again, you have this paradox that, you know, eventually we all turn to the court. Eventually, every debate in India, and in this case, what the Supreme Court tried to do was to say, look, this is not our decision. It's a little bit like the debate the Americans are having about abortion, right? Or what the US Supreme Court says. It's not our decision. Let this be decided by law, by the executive, by the political executive. But the outrage was so enormous that now you have the Supreme Court back in sort of the arbiter's mode. And we've actually seen since this case in the last week, the Supreme Court released in another case rape convicts in a state government in Madhya Pradesh, a similar thing has happened. So for me, sexual violence is a very, very, it's a minefield, and it's totally ad hoc in the way justice is delivered, right? Maybe Rohit knows more about this, but we don't go by, so this is a precedent in law, and therefore now every judge will interpret it like that. It is totally dependent on the individual thinking of an individual judge. And so you have no consistent patterns within which the Constitution will also be interpreted, or the idea of equality will be interpreted.
Absolutely. And maybe tying this with Roni's earlier comments, in some ways the most effective engagements with courts are when there is a larger social movement that is backing or supporting a claim. So, I mean, an example Barkha gave earlier was the Supreme Court's decriminalization of homosexuality. Prior to the decision, just about a couple of years before that, the court had actually upheld criminalization of homosexuality and said LGBT Indians are a minuscule minority and not almost deserving of these rights. This prompted a significant sort of engagement with LGBT groups in the public space. A lot of prominent people came out. People appeared on all kinds of media, both English and vernacular media, to talk about what decriminalization might mean for them. And it was in some ways also saying that the Supreme Court doesn't decide whether we have rights or not. The Constitution gives us these rights. And in the final judgment, one of the judges said that we are not giving you these rights. You've always had these rights. We are merely recognizing that these rights belong to you. And we see this in other ways. So all groups can mobilize, and they might not necessarily be groups that we agree with. But a variety of groups try to push what their interpretation, imagination of the Constitution is. And they do that through a variety of ways. And it usually requires the existence of some kind of sort of supportive network, either a social movement or access to media, or in some cases, just sort of elite status where people or the ability to make a lot of noise. And I think we need to think through more carefully what this relationship is. Some of the most important interventions made by the court, and I know Rohini's research picks up on some of these, are things like what led to the legislative programs around the right to food and right to employment. These were talked about at the time of independence. They were put into the Constitution, or in some cases not even mentioned as sort of promissory things in the future. But social movements located in rural India in the 70s and 80s took these up as serious claims and then eventually went to court. The court recognized it. And then the social movements leveraged the court judgment and compelled the government to bring about, in a more watered-down form, some legislative changes, which created like a basic welfare state structure for India. So you can't have just the court. We can't concede the power just to the court. And one needs to have a larger mobilization for the Constitution's interpretation to sort of come into play.
Yeah. I mean, I just jump in on this idea of where the rights agenda has gone and is going in India and how it's linked to the Constitution, because it's something that I think is not just a question of how much the state pushes it, but it's also had a lot of political overtones over time. So I think, as Rohit said, based on a number of social movements in the early 2000s, we saw implementation of these rights, which in some ways have formed the only, I'd say, broad-based social protection system we have in, certainly in rural India, is like, for instance, the right to employment and social protection, the right to food. At the time of COVID, both of these turned out to be the most important social protection nets for the poor, partly because the state, unlike in the US or Europe or other places, chose not to provide a lot of direct transfer. They provided a short amount of direct transfer, but largely said the labor markets are going to be the way we are going to get the poor back on their feet. But what we see in throughout in the data is, especially in rural areas, the employment guarantee was an incredibly important social protection net. And interestingly, it was the one thing that for a short amount of time has reversed the decline of rural women falling out of the labor force, because at a time of distress, these women have actually gone back to work through this employment guarantee scheme. And certainly other evidence suggests that once you enter the labor force, you're empowered in other ways. So I think that's been extremely important. I think now there's another ongoing discussion, which is really, do the rights entitle you to benefits, or do they just entitle you, for instance, to be able to enter the labor market and you need to earn a living? And I think this is a debate that's going to continue. It's broader than India, as things like automation is becoming increasingly part of industry. We're going to have a lot of, you know, surplus labor who don't want to work in agriculture anymore. They're far too educated to want to do that, but there are no jobs in manufacturing and only a limited number of jobs in services. So I think this idea of what rights they're going to demand is going to become extremely important, and it's going to play out politically as well.
Rohini, just another follow-up question for you. Earlier when Rohit was talking about how, you know, groups can mobilize, but they require a supportive network, and we're talking about social movements. I know a growing priority in development work in India is supporting women's groups. And I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit more. And I know a lot of your research is also focused on the fact that development has to be intentional, the role of institutions. So just kind of talking about development efforts now and how they might support or perhaps not adequately support these institutions for women, women's groups, for example. What are your thoughts on that?
So let me actually cite someone else's work here on self-help groups in India. So there's a political scientist at Stanford, Soledad Preleman. And she actually did a lot of field work in rural Madhya Pradesh, one of the states that Barkha mentioned earlier, to really ask what does it take for women to have political voice in a village, especially, and I think this is something hopefully we'll come to in this discussion, especially if having political voice is to go against your husband in some ways. And so she argues that basically self-help groups played an extremely important role in actually getting women politically active, because what women needed was a network outside their family, outside their household. In India, you know, women migrate at the time of marriage. They typically have a child within a year of being married. So they're extremely isolated in these settings. And then you're completely dependent on your husband. And so, for instance, you know, some of the movements that women have led are things like anti-alcohol. That's been recently a strong movement, something not your husband is going to want. And so you need to have this network outside. And I think that's the kind of thing where she's found that self-help groups played an important role. Just one thing to flag, and we can come back to this later. I think I love to hear from Rohit and also Barkha about really the contradictions, if any, in the Constitution and how far they were willing to go in, say, giving women's rights when they had to enter the household to do that.
There were a number of very active, visible women members in the Assembly. And for them, it was clear that freedom was not just political freedom alone. And amongst the things they were proposing was the right for women to give consent to marriage and a kind of radical rehaul of all the laws governing the family, alongside laws around the workforce. In the Constitution itself, the right to have autonomy and consent for marriage was not accepted by the male members. And the question of reforming family laws was sort of put in a kind of cold storage compartment, and it wasn't really clear what those reforms meant. In the 1950s, Nehru's government put its sort of shoulder to changing a lot of the laws that affected Hindu families. And while on paper they seem quite radical, in practice they actually gave very limited rights. And in some ways, actually, and going back to something Rohini was talking about earlier, empowered younger men to sort of free themselves from family control more than they empowered women. And this has been a kind of contestation from the beginning about what does it mean for constitutional law to step into the domain of the household. And the courts have ruled in every possible way. And there's some infamous judgments where the court says constitutional law in the bedroom is like a bull in a china shop. And there are other judgments that really take the promise of equality seriously and sort of try and tinker and change a lot of pre-existing laws. So the example Barkha was giving on the sort of finding triple talaq to be a practice that's not to be given legal sanction. It was a complicated decision because it was, for once, something that Muslim women had themselves stepped forward and asked for. It was happening at a time when Indian Muslims felt that they were being discriminated and marginalized by the state, and their identity meant it was important to sort of hold on to the law. And the court sort of gave a number of judgments. And in its final holding, one of the judges actually did not sort of rely on the Constitution. Two judges relied on the Constitution and said this is unconstitutional. Two judges turned to the Constitution and said this is absolutely constitutional because the Constitution protects religious laws. And the fifth judge said that, well, triple talaq is un-Islamic because if you look at what Islam requires, and it's a kind of modernist reading of Islamic texts. And that's actually what the women who had appeared before the courts were asking for. Because for them, the point wasn't that their husbands should go to prison if they sort of make this declaration. Their point was that we do not want this practice to be recognized by the state, but also by our communities. We want the court to support it. Where a simple answer saying this is unconstitutional might not have worked for speaking to the community.
But I'm extremely uncomfortable with this essential doctrine approach to the rights of women, and it's ongoing in another context, which is women in the southern state of Karnataka, young women really want the right to wear the hijab if they should so choose to educational institutions. And of course, one of the framings of that debate has also been, is it essential practice in Islam? And I mean, this is such a complicated subject because one has views as a feminist and one has views as a multiculturalist, and sometimes those views collide or sometimes those instincts collide. And in this particular case, I think it's quite possible to say at some point that it doesn't matter whether something is deemed to be an essential religious practice if it collides with the universal value, and there has to be some idea of universal values. But at the other hand, if you frame this as a right to education debate, there can be no justification for keeping women outside of the classroom. I mean, I think that's just a travesty. Yeah. So I think this idea of reforming family law has become like the political hot potato of our time. It's called the Uniform Civil Code. The Constitution talks about it as an ideal aspiration. But it is such a politicized conversation now that it's impossible to divorce it from contemporary politics. And so it's got very murky. On the other hand, it's heartening for me, and this takes me back to my original idea that everybody looks to the Constitution as a kind of aspiration of hope, that there are other groups that have come up with what they call a progressive uniform civil code, where they said that, look, we have to be very careful that if you are saying that certain universal values must apply across religious communities, that cannot be the dominance of one religion over the other. So it cannot be a Hindu uniform code. It has to be a kind of code that transcends communities, irrespective of who they are, to say, look, this is what all women deserve, irrespective of whether they're Hindu, Muslim, Sikh or Christian. I was also reminded, before there was triple talaq, there was the Shah Bano case, which turned, in a way, the tide in the direction of Indian politics, right? And just for the audience, very briefly, Rohini and Rohit obviously know this, is a Muslim woman goes to the court and says that alimony is my right. The Supreme Court agrees. She is granted alimony. And the government of the day, which is the Rajiv Gandhi government, basically passes a law in parliament to contradict what the Supreme Court decides. And so you also have often this contradiction or this collision between different institutions. And honestly, I do believe that single decision in some ways changed the course of Indian politics. It changed the course of politics well beyond the place of women in society.
And I think it's also a guide as to what judges do. So the Shah Bano case did what other high courts had done in the past without too much of a reaction. But what became problematic at that time was the way in which the court tried to interpret religion and the language that they used, which sort of provoked insecurities, and the government sort of easy succumbing to, in some ways, the most conservative voices in a community. I also think the point Prakha made is really great, that we often focus on uniform civil code and we just keep talking about uniformity, but uniformity by itself is not a goal. The goal really has to be either equality or dignity or something else, because you could have a uniform civil code which says polygamy is legal for everyone, right?
Yeah.
And in some ways that conversation is only now being had.
Barka, I want to bring up a piece you recently wrote where you said, "For years I have argued with foreign correspondents who have looked at us through the prism of subjugation and stereotypes, pointing out that our complex realities defy Orientalist tropes." Can you expand on those misconceptions?
When I came as a young woman to study in the United States of America, I had an American flatmate, and I kind of personally experienced what she assumed my life as a woman in India would be. And some of it was true. Some of those assumptions were true, and some of those assumptions were completely misplaced. And structurally, when I look, for example, at the debate around abortion in India, and the debate, there is no debate around abortion in India. And when I contrast it with what's happening here, or when I look at the idea of a powerful woman, we're a very contradictory country, because we've had women lead us, but yet we do also resent in our daily lives women who sort of exude power. So I think what I was arguing in that op-ed was for granularity. and for the recognition that the battles women fight are universal. Women fight different battles located in their own cultural and political context, but those battles are universal. And somehow there's this kind of Western gaze that stereotypes a one part of the world in a certain way. It's just without texture. There's just no understanding of the pulls and pushes of that make up that fight. So I think a good starting point would be to recognize that these are universal questions. These are global questions for women, that women are fighting these battles everywhere in different ways with different kinds of pushbacks. And once we recognize that basic equality to our battle, I think we can have a fairer conversation. This, Rohini flagged this, that what happened when it was about entering the bedroom? Did the Constitution stop there? And Rohit would be best placed to answer where the Constitution stopped. I don't look at it like that. Maybe historically that's true. I still look at it as making the rights of the Constitution. You know, there's an elasticity to how you interpret the word equality, justice, fraternity. And I would apply contemporary values to that understanding. And so, for example, one of the ongoing debates right now, and I actually believe we will see this change very soon, is the law in India does not recognize marital rape. And the last time there was an attempt to bring in this as a law in Parliament, there was cross-party unanimity. It was across parties' unanimity, including by parties that were led by women, that this was not a law. It would end the institution of marriage. That was the consensus. We're now seeing a very distinct shift in the observations made by the court, including observations made by the man who's going to be the next Chief Justice of India, who's already the Chief Justice, effectively, of India, including by political members, younger politicians. You're seeing that shift. So I think Rohit made this important point about the correlation between movements and law. You know, you need kind of both to often exist. Sometimes the people are ahead of the law. Sometimes the law is ahead of the people. Sometimes it's like it's a perfect coincidence. But marital rape is a good example of something that's absent in the law, but where the Constitution's basic premise of equality is being cited again and again and again to say, we need this law. And I actually am optimistic. You know, I might feel cynical about many things, but I feel optimistic this law will happen pretty soon.
I jump in on one thing on thinking about issues of power and how they play out. And I think this also comes to not thinking about abortion as a single issue. Because I think in India, a very different discussion is around population control. So this could be, you know, during the emergency where a lot of women were sterilized. But even now, in essentially all our reproductive support laws, there's a lot of emphasis on trying to ensure fertility doesn't rise too much. So, for instance, one of India's big problems is sex-selective abortions. How do you think about legalizing abortion but not legalizing sex-selective abortion? And to the extent you try to prevent that, for instance, by which many states do now, is by providing some kind of cash transfer programs if you have a girl, how the state also takes a very strong view that they don't want to increase fertility through it. So I've talked to policymakers who've said that, yes, you know, we are going to provide these transfers, but we don't want them to be known to people to women before they get pregnant, because then they'll just get pregnant to have children. So I think, yes, India has been very progressive abortion, but if you think of the most central question about women's control over their body, which extends arguably to deciding to have many children if they want to have them, I think India has been a lot less progressive there, both on the state side. And, you know, again, I would turn to Rohit, really just ask explicitly, I don't know whether on bodily rights the Constitution ever tried to say anything.
The Constitution was used by a number of different groups to get recognition for violence to bodily autonomy, and it led to some important legal reforms. So whether it's the rape law reforms in the 1980s or after the Nirbhaya incident, or in some ways, perhaps the most successful intervention, which is the Domestic Violence Act, which engages in family law, did not annoy any religious groups, and covers not just sort of wives, but basically all dependents who might live inside the household. But the problem with all these legal reforms is once the law is passed, your ability to sort of draw upon it, you're dependent on your local police station. Yeah. And what happens inside the local police station. So it's not even, and I very much hope that the law will change to recognize something like matrimonial rape. The question really is what enables somebody to actually draw upon the law to be able to access a police station, to make a complaint, to see through the investigation. And in one of the reasons, many of our legal reforms in comparison to what happens even in the West sometimes seem to be more advanced, better engaging with sort of women's groups. But once the law is passed, in its implementation, there seems to be a major gap. And it's partly because the institutions tasked with implementing them have not changed in terms of personnel or
and therefore it's societal. I think we underestimate the fact that, yes, you still need the law even if society doesn't think that way. That's the whole idea of having a constitution. But the complete stigma, even today, India has a law to where you can't in the media name a rape survivor. I actually personally, I know why this law exists, but I personally think it reinforces every stigma about rape. You interview survivors of sexual harassment and domestic violence and sexual violence in silhouettes. And I remember interviewing the mother of the woman whom we now know as Nirbhaya. Nirbhaya means without fear. And her Asha Devi would keep saying, my daughter's name is why don't you take her name? And it was like almost like the entire country had foisted this sort of collective idea of this fearless sort of woman. She was a 23-year-old who was killed and gang raped with a rod inserted inside her private parts. And so this enforced idea of being fearless, you know, because the country needs a metaphor, but at the same time not having a legally being barred from naming. I know it's well-intentioned, but it's still problematic to me. It is problematic to me that we are legitimizing that kind of social stigma, even where people want it, even where families want to name, like the media has to think twice, okay, am I allowed to, am I not allowed to, because we could just get slapped with a police case if we named a rape survivor today.
I do want to make sure we talk about the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on women and girls in India. Barkha, I know you've focused a lot of your reporting on this over the past almost 3 years, and I'm hoping you can share a bit more and also help us connect this discussion on COVID-19 with the conversation we're having on the role of the Constitution and the law.
Like I always say, the pandemic was called the great equalizer, but it was actually the exact opposite. I think that was globally true, that wherever there was structural inequity, that inequity was actually exacerbated. It worsened during the pandemic. So to that extent, if we acknowledge that, you know, there is no perfect equality between men and women in India, women experienced the pandemic in a much more devastating way than men. And the reasons are manifold. The reasons go back to the fact that no law is able to mandate equality at home. You can mandate equality or legislate on equality at the workplace, but how do you legislate on equality at home? And in the absence of equality at home, we saw straight away almost a spike in the number of domestic violence, reported domestic violence cases. We saw a spike in the number of calls being made by children to the government-run child helpline as girls were pushed into underage marriage. The reason that this happened is because schools were physically shut down, and therefore in rural India, in particular, where a family may have only one internet device, if there was a brother and a sister, the brother would get the access to the classroom and the daughter would be told, what are you doing? We may as well marry you off. There was stories of extraordinary resistance to this as well. I mean, in one village, the girls answered the, what are you doing if you aren't going to school? Let's get you married by forming a football team, trained with local activists to play football professionally. Some of them now play professionally for the state of Rajasthan. But not every story had that kind of happy ending. And even in upper middle class homes where that equality at home continues to be absent and roles are very gendered in a conventional way at home, women suddenly found their partners at home not really picking up the slack for housework, their children at home, so having absolutely not even 8 hours in the day away to do their own work, and then the demands of work. And so millions of women dropped out of the workforce. And then, of course, like at every stage, the access to vaccines. I mean, I know Rohini's done research on this, so she can better speak to it, but a gender divide in the access to vaccines, pregnant women got the vaccine late. So at every level, you had women experiencing the pandemic with much graver consequences that I think continue to be in some ways felt today. Those women who, I mean, I think data shows, again, I'm not an expert, that a larger percentage of men were able to return to the workforce than women, even though as the pandemic subsides.
I mean, I think the one thing I'd add is consequences of the pandemic, a lot of them were economic. And I think it it reflects the fact that often the reach of the law is harder to achieve that when people are up against the wall when it comes to economic resources. So, for instance, child marriage. This is something that's outlawed in India. And I think India was doing reasonably well in maintaining some progress. And in fact, if anything, you know, the discussion now is should the marriage age be increased from 18 to 21. But at the same time, you know, when schools shut down, girls are at home, and it's in some ways, it's not even necessarily just you don't have the money and so you think of marriage, but it's also, you know, this fear that if girls are roaming around outside school, you know, what will happen to them? Will their reputation get tarnished? Will they actually be maybe face some amount of sexual harassment? That just led, all of that seems to have led to an increase in underage marriage for girls. And this is, you know, the constitution didn't change, the legal apparatus didn't change, but the economic opportunities, the educational opportunities changed. And that, I think, shows that in the end, laws don't cause development, development doesn't cause laws, but somehow that intersection remains very important.
I just want to maybe add a kind of historical footnote to this. So clearly one of the structural problems is both in times of COVID and in normal times for women to just engage in public spaces in India without sort of being restricted in a variety of ways. So in the Constituent Assembly, when they were debating the Equality Clause, one of the people pointed out that if you have a simple right to equality, you can't have reserved seats on buses for women or parda parks for women. And Rajkumari Amrit Kaur said, if women don't have the opportunity to step into a park where they can breathe, I'd rather just not have equality and keep my segregated parks. So there is a longstanding sort of demand for a way in which public spaces need to be structured to allow women to engage and participate in them. And I don't think we've had that conversation beyond maybe a few social movements about reclaiming the night or sort of challenging hostel protocol. And it's not been taken up in any kind of political way.
Given this milestone for India, 75 years of independence, given the impacts we've seen in COVID, I would love to hear from each of you what you hope for in terms of the role of the Constitution, the role of the law, and its very real implications for women and girls in India moving forward.
So I think the last few years have made it quite clear that the Constitution plays a kind of outsized role in popular imagination. And more groups of people, I think, are willing to turn to it even after sort of losing judicial decisions to still make claims for rights. And I hope to see this growing. I'm perhaps going to talk about my identity. And I think in terms of perhaps what needs to dramatically change is for Indian men to also revisualize what they are supposed to be under the Constitution. So I think we've had a situation, a lot of focus has been on empowering women, but what happens in a society where women have heightened consciousness, but the men still think like they did 20 years ago. So maybe thinking more clearly about what needs to be done to have that to change.
Yeah, I just pick up on one aspect of that is that, you know, one of the great successes of the Indian state in a lot of ways has been universalizing certainly primary education. And I think, you know, it's a country that now needs to think about how it's going to deal with women who are a lot more educated, will have access to things like social media, irrespective of what you do. You may try to take their cell phones away or other things, but it's going to happen. And I agree completely with Rohit that reimagination of when you have a population that's just a lot more educated is going to require us to think about what the other half of the population does. I think without that, there's a fear that it becomes sort of a zero-sum game, that especially after the pandemic, when economic opportunity is possibly restricted, you can either take the view that, which every World Value Survey tells us is true for India, that a much higher proportion of the population think that men have more of a right to a job than a woman, or you can actually try to seriously engage with the question that maybe, you know, we are more than the sum of our parts, kind of getting good talent allocation is going to leave everyone better off. But I think we're not there right now, and I think trying to figure how to get there is going to be critical.
I mean, I'm really glad that we touched upon how to make men part of this movement for progress, because I'm reminded of a similar study in the United States of America. I think I read a book called Stiffed by Susan Faludi, and she looked at how men had just been left behind as women went forged ahead, and how that was creating all sorts of societal churn, possibly even violence. And you had this sort of entire community of somewhat bewildered men who actually no longer had maybe even the instruments to negotiate this sort of changed circumstance. I have a slightly, I would say, contentious point to make in the end. I just believe that one of the social changes that I would really look forward to is a lessening of the premium placed on marriage. I think for Indian women, the sort of pursuit of marriage is something that often at a very young age obstructs their idea of being able to imagine their lives more fully. And this happens at a, because it happens so young, you know, when people are so young, or women are so young in particular, I have seen a sense of women holding back dreams, putting them aside, then finding that they're young mothers, then putting them aside further, and then getting to their midlife and just having like a bunch of regrets, but having been culturally conditioned to basically romanticize the idea of the selfless, sacrificing woman. And so I really look forward to more selfish women.
Well, thank you all so much for a great conversation. And a huge takeaway for me is something Rohini mentioned when she said, law doesn't cause development, development doesn't cause laws, but that intersection remains important. So for anyone working on development priorities, whether in India or anywhere in the world, as all of you have mentioned, this is a fight happening throughout the world for gender equality and women's empowerment. And so these lessons and these insights are relevant globally. Thank you all so much for your time.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
That's all we have time for in this episode of Voices in Development. Thank you to everyone who helped to make it happen, including our guests who joined us at the Yale Broadcast Studio and several members of the Economic Growth Center team, including EGC Communications and Policy Associate Zara Abdul-Ralph, Vestal McIntyre, Communications Director at EGC, and EGC Production Intern Bomi Okuyiga. If you'd like to learn more about the Economic Growth Center, you can visit the website at egc.yale.edu and look for the next installment of Voices in Development on EGC's website, or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.